You're listening to the Embroidery Podcast. I'm your host, Masako Newton. Thanks for tuning in. In this episode, we talk about textile conservation. Let's get started. Hi everyone, it's Masako here. Today we have a special guest, Rebecca Bissonnet. Rebecca is a textile conservator, and actually, she's a graduate of the RSM apprenticeship, so Mark and Becky know her for a long time. And in the past, she came back to the RSM embroidery studio when we had some big projects, so that's how I know her. I also attended her workshops to learn about textile conservation and restoration. So when the textile conservation came up as a topic of a podcast episode, we knew right away we would ask Rebecca to join us. Let me read out her professional bio. After completing an apprenticeship at the Royal School of Needlework, Rebecca went on to study a Master of Art in Textile Conservation, completing her MA in 2003. After graduating, Rebecca worked on short-term contracts and on a freelance basis for 11 years, working on a variety of objects from 1960s TV puppet, ethnographic and ecclesiastical textile, to costume and Grayson Perry tapestries. Work took her all over the UK and out to the Middle East, and she was also part of the embroidery team who worked on Catherine the Princess of Wales's wedding dress. In 2015, Rebecca secured a permanent position as textile treatment supervisor at historic royal palaces, where she led a team of conservators taking care of the state beds and throne canopies at Hampton Court and Kensington Palace. Time for a new adventure, and in 2021, Rebecca set up her own conservation practice, working both in her studio and on-site for a variety of institutions and private clients. Right. When we recorded with Rebecca, Mark couldn't join us, unfortunately. But we included her question to Rebecca, of course. Now, let's get started. Here's Becky.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Embroidery Podcast. This is episode 2 of season 3. And this week, we are delighted to have textile conservator Rebecca Bissonnet with us, who we've known, well, I've known for many years. So it's lovely. I can actually see you. We have also our host Masako. Hi, Masako.
Hi. Thank you for joining us today, Rebecca.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me along. It's lovely to see you.
Shall I start with a question?
Yeah.
Well, Rebecca, as a conservator, what do you do on a daily basis? What's your day like?
Okay, so sometimes I'll be on site, so I'll be going out to a property, but sometimes I'm working in the studio, and I suppose the process is always very similar. I'll often start with, you know, looking at an object and then deciding what needs to be done to it, and then thinking of all the different approaches that I can, you know, treat this object in a certain way, and then. So that might be a block of time that I'm doing that. Other days I might just be actually starting the work on the textiles. So that might be doing a stitch treatment. It might be doing some cleaning. And they tend to all come in blocks as I suppose groups of objects as well. So I'll have a group of objects that I'm, you know, assessing, and then I might have a group of objects that I'm actually working on. So I have sort of two or three sets of objects out in the studio at one time, just to kind of keep the program rolling, because you kind of get to a certain point where you might have to ask the client you know, do they want this bit doing or that bit doing? So that how you know that object might be on hold for a while, and then I can start doing some work on another object. So I suppose it's quite a lot of planning, and then it's just kind of keeping things ticking over. Yeah, maybe that's just the way I work, though.
Yeah. But, what's the first thing you do when you're assessing the piece?
Yeah, so the first thing we'll do is just looking. So looking and recording. So I'll, you know, take photographs. I will take dimensions, you know, measurements, record what the textile's made of, you know, what's its condition. For example, maybe it's a pelmet, maybe it's got holes, you know, along the top, maybe it's sagging. So that might be because it's not being, you know, hung properly. So having a look at the condition of the object, having a look at how it's used. So that'll be the first thing I do. And then finding out what the client wants. So that's really important, finding out what they want to do with the object once it is conserved. So take all that information, and then I can think about how that object can be treated.
So many kinds of treatments, no?
Yeah, there's a whole variety of treatments. And so it depends on what the client wants, you know, what's actually going to happen to the object once it is conserved. So that will influence the treatment. So say you had a wedding dress and it was going to be worn, then that would have a different treatment to if that same wedding dress was going to be put into storage. If it's going to go into storage, you have to think about the storage space. You have to think about, you know, is it going to be hung in storage? Is it going to go into a box? How much space has somebody got? So yeah, that's one of the first questions, is asking, why do you want to get this conserved? What are you actually going to do with it? And then there's a whole range of treatments that I can do. So I always start off with cleaning, always start off with surface cleaning. And this is using, you know, low powered vacuum suction and brushes to lift off the surface soiling. And at that point, I can have a really good look at the object as well. So really see everything that nobody else can see. You know, you spend quite a bit of time there with the Hoover and the brush. And that's when you get to see the seams, you get to see the stitching, you know, there might be a little hidden bits and pieces in an object, and then you can really get to see the condition as well, because sometimes they can look quite stable or quite strong, and then once you start handling them or, you know, getting a little bit closer to them, you realise how fragile they can be. So that's always the first thing I start off with. And then you can do certain levels of cleaning if you want to, but there's always a question about, depending on what's going to happen to the object, whether you do carry out cleaning or whether you don't clean. So that's another thing that you need to think about. For example, there might be staining or soiling on a particular object that may be significant to its past. It may give clues to how the object was used in the past. So you may question whether you actually want to remove that soiling. So that's the first thing you have to think about. Well, one of the first things, yeah. But yeah, but then if you do want to clean, there's another whole range of things that you can do. You can do wet cleaning, basically washing, depending on the type of material, depending on whether it's made of different fabrics, different layers. You have to obviously test everything very thoroughly before you do any kind of cleaning or treatment, but particularly with wet cleaning. So yeah, you may do that. You may just do mechanical cleaning, which is things like dry sponges, where you can lift out a bit more of that ingrained soiling. So, you know, things like metalwork embroidery, that isn't an object that you'd necessarily be able to wet clean, but you could do the surface cleaning and mechanical cleaning on something like that. And even using things like tweezers and mounted needles, you know, just to get into all those little nooks and crannies and get that dirt out. So yeah,
very satisfying.
Say again.
very satisfying. That must be what's
I was weaving
so...
some pelmets today, and they're chintz, and they would have been white, and they've all gone yellow, and it was very satisfying for me hoovering them. Basically, the dust that came off them was amazing. And then I was using cosmetic sponges to lift the soiling. So unfortunately, they don't look any different, but I've got a big bucket of dirty sponges. So if anybody asks, I can say, look how much dirt I've got off these.
The big bucket. Yeah. I thought you were going to say a bag of... And then you said a bucket of,
yeah.
It's like, what?
Oh. Yeah, it's a pelmet. It's huge. It's a lot of dirt on there.
Oh, wow.
Do you work on all ranges of textiles? So it's not just embroidery as such. It could be a tapestry, a woven piece, or a printed piece. Would you work on all of those things, or are there limits?
Yeah, so I do. I work on anything basically as a textile. And they vary from, like you say, curtains, tapestries, woven pieces, to shoes, to costume. Like, costume's quite varied. I just had a whole stage of doing flags. Loads of flags kept coming in. and they're quite interesting because sometimes they're printed. So you've got the fabric, and then you've got the printing as well. So you might have the painting. Had some that had gold paint on. So that's another level of trying to work out what to do, and consulting other conservators who might have a specialism in that particular medium. And then embroidered banners. I had a lovely double-sided, both sides alike embroidered banner, which is, I love it when I get the embroidery in, because I was an apprentice at the Royal School of Needlework. Yes. So that is my foundation of learning. Mm-hmm. So when I get the embroidery in, it's great, because I'm like, oh yeah, that's that stitch and that stitch. And then because you understand how it was made, you can understand what the weaknesses are, and then you can that influences obviously how you treat things as well.
So how did you kind of transition from, obviously, as you say, you did the apprenticeship in embroidery, that's how we all know each other.
Yeah.
And then you did a course at Winchester, was it?
Yeah, so after I'd done when I started my apprenticeship, I decided in my second year that I wanted to go and work in, I didn't know it was conservation. I thought, I'll go and work at the National Trust. And obviously, because I've done a course in hand embroidery, they will just employ me. Yeah. And I didn't know that this job, textile conservation, existed. I just thought, I'll go and work in a great big house, and I will look after the textiles. So you have to do a formal qualification, which I didn't realise. So that was the first big surprise. And also the second one was that you had to have chemistry. So after I'd done the apprenticeship, I then did a year of chemistry. So the course I did was called Chemistry for Conservators. And when I did it, it was done via post. So they would send you the experiments in the post. You'd then do the experiments, and then you'd send the results back, and then you'd have your papers marked. So
well,
I did that.
Distance learning.
Yeah, distance learning. Yeah. And all before you did it online, which is quite interesting because, I'm not a chemist or a scientist. So I just, I had the little test tubes and the, I don't know what chemicals they sent. You had to just do these little experiments and... And then somebody would mark them, and then write their comments on your papers and then send them back. So it's quite a lengthy process, I suppose, because obviously it all had to go via post. So once I'd got that, I then did a master's in textile conservation, which at the time was based in Winchester. So it was a 2 years master's. Which again for me was a bit of a shock, because I'm a hands-on person and I hadn't been to university, they took me on my experience from the apprenticeship. And when we did our apprenticeship, we did a business studies course as well. So they took that for the, you know, for the writing and essay writing. But yeah, I hadn't written an essay since I was at school. So going to do a master's and having to write all of that, all of those words, it was just a bit of a shock. But anyway, I got through it. Yeah, so that sort of led me into conservation, which at that time, again, a lot of the jobs, because they're sort of all based on the income of a museum, so it's all based on, you know, sort of the budgets and getting people in. I did 11 years on short-term contracts, sort of travelling from, you know, different museums and organisations, until I got a permanent job for Historic Royal Palaces. So that's, yeah, finally got a permanent job, which was quite, yeah, which was great. I was looking after the tapestries and the furnishings at Historic Royal Palaces. But I ended up doing quite a lot of managing, and I decided that I thought I was probably better at doing the hands-on, and that's the bit I really enjoy, like actually hands-on working with the textiles, working out what to do with them. And so I decided to leave. So yeah, so I set up my own business 2 years ago, and yeah, I've been really busy ever since. But yeah, that's the short version of how I got into conservation, really.
I was going to ask you if you still do any embroidery for yourself, or do you, I guess you don't have time, you're busy and you're...
Yeah, I do. I try and keep my hand in because I really enjoy it, actually. I do a little bit of teaching. So I've got these series of embroideries that I do. So my big plan... My plan at the end of the day is to write a book. So I've been planning this for like 20 years. And so now I've got stage one. So I thought I'd do it in, like, I'd do insects to start with in all different embroidery techniques.
Oh,
so
wow.
So I've nearly finished that. But yeah, it's, yeah, and by the time I get home.
Would it be linked to conservation as well?
No, I just thought.
Brilliant. Embroidery, yeah.
I just thought I'd, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't hold your breath. Like I say, it's 20 years. I've got the insects done, stage one. I was then going to do birds and mammals. So I reckon by the time I retire, I might have finished the bird section.
It's a huge project.
Yeah.
I know. I see all these books and I think, oh, it's such a nice thing to do. And I always keep notebooks. I don't know if you... keep notebooks, you know, if I'm like doing a design. I do like the designing and then you know, working out, you know, and then doing the stitching and you know, I like to make all the little notes and all the fabrics in the book, and I think, oh yeah, it'd be really nice, but, you know, have like, it's like a scrapbook, isn't it, a book of ideas. And yeah,
kind anyway. Of what you do in your job, like making notes and assessing,
yeah.
Things.
Yeah, I do that as well. I've got loads of I think we used to call them day books. So in conservation, in my everyday work, as it were, I keep a day book. So it's just, you know, jotting down, you know, any thoughts, making a little note of the materials, and I like to put little scraps of the materials into the book as well. And then because I find like when you're sitting there stitching, like your mind can wander, can't it? And then you think, ah, oh, I know how I can, you know, tackle this problem. And then I can just make a little note of it. So, yes, I've got a selection of books. And I always think, yeah, if I did that project again, I could go back to that book. And, you know, but in reality.
You must have so many books, and then do you know which book has that particular information? You have to go through all the books.
Yeah, no, I'd have to go through all the books. And I do sometimes sit and go through them. I think, oh, that was a good idea. Oh, I should do that again. But despite the fact that you think, because there's so many ways that you can treat an object, but actually every object is different. And so actually they all get treated slightly differently.
You
so
mean,
even when you think, oh yeah, I'm going to do that again, then yeah, I very rarely do. It's always slightly varied. So, but I do keep them. I flick through them. And Becky and I did a massive project together, didn't we?
We did. You had to come
nearly
stay.
Killed us.
You poor thing.
Yeah.
Come and stay in Hastings. Yeah.
It was lovely. Yeah.
That was amazing. It was a banner for the inn holders, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you saying you don't feel like you're organised? You were mega organised. I mean, you had all the, you know, you were doing all the reporting and filing and research and
tell me about this banner. Was it the embroidered banner?
Yeah, it was a plique, wasn't it?
Plique,
it was
huge. Was it like 3 meters by two or something like that?
Yeah. And when we went to look at it in a very dark room, when it was covered in nets, we thought, oh yeah, it'll take this long, and then it arrived at Becky's studio. Once he took the net off, it was like, oh my goodness, there's quite a lot of parts to this because it was a
PK. You couldn't see it on site.
Yeah, did it? No. The room was really small. It was like on a mezzanine, wasn't it? Really small, dark. It was in a cupboard. Oh God, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It was almost like a jig, because it was a banner silk. It had all just perished, hadn't it? And it was almost like a jigsaw piece.
Yes.
All the bits were kind of still there, but it was like piecing them back together.
It was slightly different,
netting it to, keep what we could in place, I suppose. That was what you I was mean, going to ask Masco.
No, you mean netting means using a conservation net.
I was going to, that was one of my questions, actually, thinking about materials that you use to conserve something. Because I don't know, I mean, I'm not a conservator, so correct me if I'm wrong, but would you use more synthetic materials? Because then those wouldn't deteriorate so quickly over time, or like you wouldn't use like a silk net because that, or would you? I don't know.
Yeah, so there's two. So first of all, you use new materials, so you wouldn't ever conserve something with so say you had a 1950s dress, you wouldn't use 1950s, you know, fabric from the 1950s, because you'd always use a new fabric, because you'd then got the strength. But there are two schools of thinking when it comes to materials. So you've got one school of thinking that thinks that you should always treat like with like. So if you've got cotton, you know, a cotton dress, you would then, if it needed say a patch support, you would use the cotton patch support and you'd use cotton threads. And then the other way of thinking is that you would use something different, so that you can then always tell that that's a later addition. So personally, I think the most important thing is that the fabrics that you use are have the same properties as the materials that you're conserving, so that they react in the same way to heat, relative humidity, temperature, so that any fluctuations, you know, in that fabric will happen with the support or the patching or whatever else you've used as well. So, and there's also a lot to consider, because if you're trying to say you wanted to treat something all with silk, you've then got to dye, you know, you potentially will have to dye the silk fabric, you'd then potentially have to dye the silk threads as well, which then that takes time, and then time is money. So it would depend on your client, depend on the budget. Whereas with synthetics, so I use a lot of polyester because it comes in very, very fine threads, and it also comes in a huge range of colours. So you're immediately, you know, taking out that chunk of time, because dyeing, if you get the colour right first time, that's great, but you're still looking at half a day, let's say. But if you get the colour, it's not quite right, then, you know, you could be looking at 2 or 3 days. So, you know, unfortunately, it does carry a cost. So So as long as your fab, like I say, as long as they're compatible, then I think that's the most important thing. And I suppose when you're supporting a textile, the idea is that you're trying to have those two fabrics, your support fabric and the original, acting as one piece of fabric. So, you know, you've got to consider the weight of that support fabric as well as what it's made of.
There's so much to think about. It's time-filled, really.
Yes, once you start, yes, once you start thinking. Yeah, you could talk yourself out of doing anything, I think.
Am I right in saying I know all the ideas with conservation are always developing and changing, but would it be right in saying that you, if say in 50 years, say like that banner we did, if it like 50 years they decided to take the net off, God forbid,
Yes.
and redo it or something, it should be easy to separate like the new
Yeah.
conservation with the original sort of thing. Does that make
Yeah.
sense?
That's right. So when I first started training, the way of thinking was that everything should be reversible. So that everything that you do as a conservator, you should be able to take it off, and then you're just left with the original. I think over time, the reality of that is, you know, if you're using an adhesive treatment and you're literally sticking down tiny fragments, realistically, if you reverse that adhesive, you are going to get some loss. So now, it's much more retreatability. So anything you do, that object should be retreatable. It should be clear. So that's why documentation is quite important, because it should be clear what you've done, what materials you've used, what adhesives you've used, so that they can be reversed. So any a conservation adhesive, they're sort of chosen for their aging properties, so that they don't yellow, they don't go hard, but also so they can be reversed relatively easily.
Not
Yeah.
copy
Yeah.
deck. I'm
Yeah.
joking, not copy decks.
Not copy decks and not
Oh
hardboard.
no, copy
But
this.
yes,
I hate that. Oh, it's horrible, yes. Not
Yeah.
nice.
Ooh.
Sorry.
Mind you, it rolls off quite easily, doesn't it, off the hardboard?
Yeah, I was actually talking of materials and things in terms of equipment. Do you have like specialist needles and pins and things that
Yeah, so again, depends what you're working on, but curve needles,
Oh, yeah.
curve needle, because often the objects are very fragile, so you have to keep them. Well, often, you know, you'd be working flat on the table. So a curved needle is great for being able to stitch. I use entomological pins as well, which are really fine
Oh.
pins. They come in various finenesses.
Yes.
And
Oh,
they're
do they come in
used.
different fine in
Yeah, so you can get them in
Didn't know
three, I
that.
think three or four. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
You can get ones that are just like a hair, you know,
Right.
it's
Yeah.
hot, yeah.
Yeah.
And they are insect pins, so they would have been used to, you know, pin up insects when people did that.
Yeah.
People probably still do that, but I don't know.
Exotic butterflies. Oh.
Yeah, a lot of other stuff. It's I've used a lot of things. So once I had to wash this braid, it was really long and it was really fragile. So I really wanted to keep it flat and, you know, in one length. So I used guttering, square-based guttering, because then I could make a long bath, one length, put it in. Yeah, it was great. Yeah. So you have to think a little bit out of the box and think about what you can use.
Actually, the that banner, I'm sure I went to buy some gutter, like a mass or a, no,
Oh
like
yes, the drain
a
pipe.
drain pipe. So it was big enough and strong enough to roll the banner around
Yeah.
for
I see. Yeah, I wasn't
the
what a
travel.
drain pipe. A drain pipe. And then the other day when I was taking down a pelmet, I used a drain pipe. And I also, because I had to have had to get the height to get up to the pelmet. And then, so the drain pipe was standing upright, and then we had to move it along behind the pelmet and roll the pelmet on. So in order to do that, I bought a, I call them a dolly. So basically it's a bit of wood with wheels, and they're used when you're moving house. You can put all your boxes on top of them and move your boxes around. Yeah, so I got one of those, and then I put a table leg in the middle of it to hold the drain pipe. So there you go. And then you can reach the high point and get, you have to think outside the box.
I was just looking, because obviously Marg couldn't join us this time. There were a couple of questions she had. She says, Rebecca had a story about shoes, possibly ancient. Could she tell us about that?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I wonder what she's thinking about. I did get... I worked on a pair of boots once, and they were flat. They were made of silk. They were almost like calf length, I think, but they were flat. So I don't know if that's what she is thinking of. So these were flat archaeological pieces, I think. And so that was quite interesting, because they had to... and they wanted them to go on display. So I had to shape them, but they were full of really fine soiling as well. So that was one of those situations where I had to think, do you remove all of that soiling? Do you basically vacuum it all up? Or do you keep it, because it might be evidence of where the shoes had come from? So I did leave it in the end. I removed some of it from, I think, from the outside, and then I kept it in a, put it in a sample bag. And then they were going to be displayed on a mount. So the mount that I made was it was a padded board. And at the back of the padded board, I made a section where all of these samples of the soiling could be kept. So everything was kept together, and then the board could be used to display the boots, and then you could just lay it down flat and put it in a box so they could be used for the storage as well. So,
how old were these shoes?
Do you know what? They came with nothing, no information. So that's another thing that's quite interesting as a conservator, because I'm not a historian. So all the information I get comes from either the client or just working on objects and like doing research. And I researched them. I couldn't find anything about them. So I don't know how old they are. But they were, yeah. So I thought, well, I don't know, so I won't guess. Because I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we do. You know, people ask, "Oh, how old is this?" And we have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. It's I had a jacket I was working on the other day, and the guy didn't know anything about it. Again, this just turned up in the post in a tiny little package. And anyway, so I treated it, and then I wrote back to him and said, "Yeah, so I finished the work on the jacket. It's 1858." And he was like, "Oh, wow, it's amazing. How do you know?" And I said, "Well, I would like to put it down to my years of experience, but there was a label inside the pocket."
I have another request from Marg.
Oh, yes.
She said, "Tell us a story about a shirt with a king's blood."
Oh, yeah. So this was a story. This is a story I told when I was teaching, actually. So I went to look at some objects when I very first started training, working actually, and I can't remember where I was, but we went past this frame that had this white shirt in there, and I was told that this shirt had been the shirt that was worn by Charles I when he had his head chopped off.
Wow.
Which I don't know whether it was or wasn't, but I think the point of that was that if that had been the shirt he was wearing, and it had got blood on the collar, and you were then asked to treat that shirt, So blood is very metallic, isn't it? And very, very corrosive. So it would eat through cotton fabric quite easily. So as a conservator, you would you remove the stain? Because obviously that's going to ruin the shirt. But if it was potentially the blood from King Charles I related to his beheading, do you keep the blood, do you keep that stain in place? So that was again another something else you have to consider when you're thinking about conservation. So
Of course you keep the blood.
then
The
it's
historic.
going to ruin the shirt. So then would you be left without a shirt? And then
King Charles the First beheaded blood.
yeah, but if the blood, what if the blood was all over the shirt and then the blood destroyed the whole shirt and then you'd have nothing?
Was it a nice shirt? Was it?
Was a very big white shirt.
Just a plain white suit shirt or frills or
Yeah. I don't remember seeing any blood on it. It was in a frame.
if a listener has a embroidered items, what's the best way to keep it?
So the main agents of decay, so you have these agents of decay, and there's nine of them in total, which will help to destroy your objects. What you should do is try and avoid all of those dangers, as it were. So, for example, if you had an embroidered picture, to its deterioration is light. So, the first thing you do is you don't hang it on the wall opposite a window. If you can hang it, in a corner, I suppose. If that's not possible, could you potentially have a blind on the window? So can you reduce the amount of light that gets to that object? So that would be one of the first things I'd say.
Rebecca, is that sunlight or is it any kind of light?
Yeah, so it's any kind of light. Yeah, sunlight, yeah, any light. So if you've got a light on an object, so it's an accumulation of light over a period of time. So if you had a light bulb just straight on that object, constantly, it's going to cause damage. If you had, say, you only expose that item to light very rarely, then it could be hung for longer. So it's an accumulation of light over a period of time. Does that make sense? So that's one of the major things. The other thing is temperature. So ideally, textiles like to be, in a constant temperature, I suppose. They like to be between 16 and 21 degrees. But, that's not always possible. So what I would say is try and keep them at a constant temperature. So don't do things like hang it above a radiator. So when the radiator comes on, you get this burst of heat. So that's not going to be any good for a textile, or above a air conditioning unit, because again you get, this burst of cold or heat or, airflow, which will affect the temperature. So yeah, try and keep them, in a relatively stable environment. Yeah, if you've got, I suppose if it's framed, that's fine because you've then got it in a closed environment. So you're not going to have, it's not going to be dusty. But if it's just hanging on the wall or, on a surface like a tablecloth or whatever, or a table covering, then it's going to get dust. So dust attracts pests. And also over a period of time, dust becomes almost like concrete. It gets very compacted. So basically, it's good housekeeping. So, get that dust off there. So use a brush, lift the dust off, and you can use a very low powered vacuum suction to you sort of whip the dust off with a brush, and then you can catch it in the Hoover or the vacuum. So yeah, good housekeeping. That way you're removing the food source as well for pests. So pest is another big thing. So if you've got textiles hanging in a wardrobe, let's say, make sure you take them out every so often. Just get a look at them. That way, not only can you see if you've got any pests or if there's anything going on, but you're also getting light into that space, and pests don't like light. So, give them a good shot of light and they should help to discourage them. Yeah.
I guess if it was a real kind of special thing, you would probably store it away, like you say, a special christening robe or a tablecloth that's sentimental. I guess you would.
Yeah.
Like you can store it in a conservation box, can't you?
Yeah, so acid free, and you can get them online, and acid free tissue. I think, like, historically, particularly white work was always kept in blue tissue. I don't know why, but then you have to imagine if that, you know, if you have a coloured tissue or a coloured box and that gets damp, that will get colour onto your embroidery or textile. So yeah, acid free tissue, acid free boxes. And again, it depends how much space you've got. So ideally, you know, you keep things flat, because then you don't get, once you start folding things up, you get a crease line, and then over time that crease line can harden, and then that's where you'll get splits. But not everybody's got the space to keep things flat, so if you do have to fold things, use your acid-free tissue, make tissue rolls so that those folds are softened, so you get a nice soft roll, and then you can fold things up. And again, if you've got stuff in storage, don't just think, yay, that's it. You know, you need to look at it. I'd get it out at least once a year. Just check, you know, once the tissue starts to go yellow, then you need to replace it. And then at that point, you can also, once you've got the, you know, got them out, you can have a look to see if there's any pests. And, you know, they might get damp, you know, depending what your storage is like. So, yeah, I check them every year or so.
Good advice. If someone needs your help or advice, how can they contact you?
Well, I do have a website. So it's www.rbtextileconservation.co.uk.
RB, yeah.
Yeah. I'm also on the Conservation Register. So ICON, which is the Institute of Conservators, has a register. So you can find all kinds of conservators there. And I'm on there too. So, yeah.
That's fantastic.
It's so fascinating. It's just, I could just sit listening to you all evening.
Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Well, that's about it for today's episode. We would love to hear from you. Please leave us a message on Spotify or DM on our Instagram. Thank you for listening, and we hope you join us again next time. Until then, happy stitching!